Thank you so much. It's an incredible thrill to be here at the American University in Cairo, and I can't tell you how thrilled we all were when Lisa told us about her new role, all of her friends and colleagues at Columbia, because we all suspected we might have a chance to be here at some point soon. And I think she will testify that when she wrote to me by email last year mentioning the occasion of the new campus and might there be some chance, it took me about 3 seconds to write that yes, because it's always a thrill to be in Cairo. I know this is the 30th anniversary year of my regular visits here, and it's a special thrill to be at the American University in Cairo, and of course it's an incredible treat to be at the American University in Cairo in the opening ceremonies of this magnificent campus, which is really breathtaking in its beauty, an inspiration to those of us at Columbia who look forward to 20 or 25 years of campus expansion, we hope, in an area just to the north of our current campus. Magnificent architecture, open spaces, students obviously feeling enormously comfortable in beautiful surroundings, is a great, great feeling. And I know that you're celebrating and you have all the reason to celebrate, so I want to congratulate you and just tell you what a pleasure it is to be a small part of this week's very, very happy events. And I might say it's nice to have happy events in the world around this time, because we don't have all that many right now. The world is in a mess for all the labors that any and all of us are trying to make. I'm afraid the circumstances are at least as troubling as they are promising. The world is a mix of contradictions, indeed. We have more technological capacity, more scientific know-how, more wealth still, even though it's $30 trillion less than it was a few weeks ago. But we still have more accumulated wealth than at any time in human history. And we also have a set of problems that are at least as challenging and harrowing as any generation has faced. And that's the paradox of our time. First coming to grips with the fact that we have this enormous capability and this enormous obvious capability to ignore problems or to exacerbate them. And from a practical point of view, we have a phenomenal challenge. And the phenomenal challenge is figuring out how to cooperate globally to solve some problems. And that's really what I want to talk about today. It's just a shorthand for the things that worry me day to day, that the Earth Institute at Columbia University is engaged in, that I know that so many parts of this wonderful institution are engaged in, and that I hope we increasingly work together on in the years to come. There are so many obvious linkages between work underway here, say the Desert Development Research Center, and the work of the Earth Institute and other partner institutions, that I do believe that together we're going to be able to crack some of these puzzles and actually make a difference. Oops. So I'm going to talk about how we might move from world crisis to sustainable development. I take the challenge of sustainable development to be the unique generational global challenge that our generation faces. I do believe that each generation faces its distinct tasks. And in the past, they may have been the challenges of world conflict, the challenges of Great Depression, the challenges of the Cold War era. But I think that the worldwide generational challenge that we face is the challenge of sustainable development. And I paraphrase that challenge in a subtitle of a recent book that I've written called Commonwealth as the economics, but it's more than that. It's the economics, politics, and society of surviving on a crowded planet. Our planet is extraordinarily crowded. By the way, Cairo's very crowded. Getting more crowded by the millions at rapid speed. The world as a whole is unprecedentedly crowded, of course. There are now 6.7 billion of us on the planet. The numbers are rising by about 80 million people per year. We are really at the end of our tether in many different biophysical dimensions of human and more generally biological life on the planet. We're putting strains on ecosystems that are literally unprecedented in scope, intensity, and certainly in scale, because this is a global challenge. It's a challenge that's only going to be solved by cooperation, and it seems to be one of the deepest traits of our species that we're not all that consistent in our capacities to cooperate. We tend to like our kith and kin, but we're not so sure about the next village and the next group and the next country and the next part of the world. And this one doesn't give us the time or the luxury to continue in the traditional mode. I think it's probably right when the anthropologist told us that our cooperation was molded in societies of maybe 50 or 75 hunter-gatherers living in a clan, pretty much working together for survival on the African savanna. And now we have to figure out how that clan of ours at 6.7 billion people and on its way to 8 or 9 billion people can find the same level of cooperation for survival. Those are the challenges that I want to talk about today and then have some discussion after my brief remarks. You can't see that way back, so let me tell you what it says. There are some fundamental drivers of the world economy right now that we need to keep in mind to understand our circumstances and our challenges. And I list four fundamental drivers and one conjunctural element right now. First, on a geopolitical level, the world is changing fundamentally. We are moving from hundreds of years of North Atlantic dominance to a much more multipolar world, but especially from sheer numbers to a world dominated by Asia. Nothing special about Asia except that about 60% of the world lives in Asia. And as per capita trends tend to even out in the world, where the people are more and more determines where the politics and the center of gravity of economics lies. And so I think that we surely are moving towards a world economy more centered in the Indian Ocean and in Asia. This region is exactly the quintessential middle region, bridging the worlds of Europe and the North Atlantic and the worlds of Asia. So there's always business and complexity at the crossroads, and this has always been the crossroads region and will remain so. But I'd say where the attention is turning, which has almost relentlessly been looking north and west for quite a long time in geopolitics, will increasingly be looking more towards the east. And one already senses this in finance, in politics, in technology, and so on. Second, and quite fundamentally, we really have run out of space and resources along our current model of development. This is really a shame. It's not a small problem, because the way that development gets done typically and can't get done anymore is that there's a lot of catching up of adopting technologies that are in play in some parts of the world and then diffuse to the rest of the world. So there's kind of an amplification of technological systems. And if the automobile is developed in one place, in the end of the day, it diffuses worldwide. And if food systems are developed in one place with suitable ecological adaptation, they diffuse worldwide. Well, the current global system has grown up, starting in the North Atlantic, from a technological base. It started with the first industrial revolution 200 years ago, and it gave birth to a fossil fuel-based global civilization. The defining element of the industrial era was the mobilization of fossil fuel energy. This is also not news for this region, but we know that we're running out of that model in many ways. It has been so successful that it has enabled a tenfold increase of the world's population. That's quite an achievement. Already in 1798, Malthus said, can't really do too much to get ahead of things because we'll run out of resources quickly and pull down living standards. 200 years of technological development seem to have given lie to Malthus's pessimism, except for the fact that, in a way, what he said in his pessimistic vision of development still hangs in the balance. He said that if there were a rise of living standards, population would come in behind it, would crowd the natural resource base, and would put at risk those advances. I and generations of economists were trained to think that's nonsense and to give learned lectures about why that's nonsense, except it's not nonsense. We don't know yet whether it's nonsense or not. We don't know whether we can find a pathway to sustainability. But what we do know, I believe, and I'll just try to illustrate this with some numbers and some elaboration, is that we can't simply go on doing what we're doing anymore. That seems to me to be pretty much unarguable. Or to put it another way, our current global development trajectory is literally unsustainable. That raises lots of questions. A late, great, and witty American economist Herbert Stein once said that things that are unsustainable come to an end. It's a theorem. And so we can be sure that this will come to an end, but we can't be sure how it will come to an end. Will it come to an end in a crash? Will it come to an end in a whimper? Or will it come to an end in a transition to a more sustainable methods of development that will allow us to continue to see rising living standards worldwide, will enable those who have been lucky to find themselves born into places that are already enjoying high levels of material well-being to continue to enjoy those, and for the rest of the world to continue to aim realistically to catch up. That's the drama that we face. But we cannot simply multiply what we're doing right now. And I'll come back to emphasize some of those points later. A third point, which obviously does not bear too much discussion in Cairo, one of the world's great cities and one of the world's most crowded cities and one of the world's most rapidly growing cities, is that we're also in a world fundamentally of urbanization. A lot of the poorest people in the world are still in the countryside. The estimate is that about 3/4 of the extreme poor in the world are rural peasant farmers, in essence, or rural landless agriculturalists. And about 1/4 of the extreme poor are living in the slums of the megacities of the world. Last week, my wife and I saw both of those kinds of extreme poverty in Western Kenya, in rural villages, where we're working quite like the projects that the American University is working on in impoverished villages. And then next door in one of the regional cities called Kisumu on Lake Victoria, in slums of massive dimension. Now, hundreds of thousands of people in slums like this in Nairobi, probably 200,000 or so in western Kenya, the numbers growing astoundingly rapidly. I think, by the way, that the visual impression of the extreme poverty in the urban areas was even more shocking, because in the rural areas, while the poor have nothing, they have land and they have a water spring, whereas in the cities there's also no land and they also have nothing. And so simply the question of how survival occurs day to day is much more puzzling. But broadly speaking, as you know, the world reached the 50% mark of urbanization, as best one can guess it, in 2008. So we're now, for the first time in human history, in an urban world. And all expectations, fundamental economic drivers, and certainly empirical trends suggest that the urbanization will continue. So this is another one of the fundamental drivers, how to make great cities like Cairo work effectively with the kind of density and complete overload of basic infrastructure and massive divides in the cities that we know to be occurring. I'd say the fourth fundamental factor of the world economy simply is an era of instability right now. And I can't see how this is going to change quickly. There's too much tumult underway. The sheer change of geopolitics by itself would at least raise a period of worry and potential instability. But add on the geopolitical changes, add together the massive numbers and growing numbers of extremely distressed people in the world, the poorest of the poor, increasing in numbers right now, not decreasing in numbers, because favorable downtrends in some parts of the world are probably being overtaken by adverse trends in other parts of the world. The ecological stress, what is likely to be the increasing struggle over resource base, and clearly governance institutions that are not functioning, hardly anywhere. The U.S. government barely works anymore. I think it gets harder and harder, even though we've elected a wonderful president. We see that within 2 weeks, if there was a honeymoon, it may have been somewhere ended between the 6th and the 7th inaugural ball. We're full into lockdown, gridlock for the moment, and I'm not sure that it's going to get any easier. At the international level, it's hard to see properly functioning institutions. And so we have a quite fundamental crisis of governance at a time of phenomenal challenge. And then the fifth point, which I would put not as at par with these other four fundamental drivers, is our conjunctural circumstance. We're in a mess of a business cycle right now. It happens to be really for the first time in perhaps the 75 years since the Great Depression, a phenomenal crisis right at the center of the world's economy. And we in New York take this personally because we live about 2 miles from the epicenter, which is Wall Street. And the collapse started there, and it's spreading throughout the world with the tremendous waves of short-term financial destabilization. as I'll explain in a few minutes, I believe that in the end, this will not turn itself into a calamity. I don't think we're on the verge of a Great Depression. But it is a bit of a mess, and it is a preoccupying mess when we have to find our way to solutions for the longer term. And it's in that regard that, and this is, I think, the absolutely most correct and strongest point of our new president and of many world leaders. We have to see this crisis as not only a conjunctural crisis, but as an opportunity for a new approach in the world. And the only way out of this crisis is going to be to take more fundamental steps to addressing the basic drivers of instability and threat that we face. Now, that turns out to be easier said than done. By the time a stimulus package gets through the Congress, the requirement has been that everything has to be tidied up and done within the first 12 months. It wasn't that Congress jumped and said, give us a long-term plan out of here. The time dimension, the thinking, the time horizon of reason, logic, and debate has become so compressed that we're not having yet a sensible discussion about the longer term, and we desperately need it. So these are the factors that I think we have to take into account. And now I'll give you the answer in 5 minutes. No, now I will explain some of my view about the underlying challenges and indeed what I believe to be the point that the economist can add, maybe the only point that the economist can add to this. And it's the following. I'll tell you the punchline up front, or most of the punchline. The sheer resource costs of getting out of this crisis, in other words, the kind of investments we need to make to address these fundamental directions of instability or unsustainability, are not what will bankrupt us. To put it positively, if we find our way as societies to mobilize the kind of resources that we're mobilizing for our bank bailouts right now, but we were to find that kind of urgency for the world's poor, for the environmental challenges, for climate change, for water stress, for conflict resolution, we would have almost no trouble from a material point of view in investing our way through this crisis. I can't even believe the numbers that are being mobilized right now because I am, as a macroeconomist, no, as a development economist, I beg for millions of dollars. I look at billions as the holy grail, and then I watch trillions go down the drain. And the point is, from a resource perspective, we could afford the billions or the tens of billions needed to solve this problem. We can't find our way, however, to the thing that economists are not necessarily very good at, and that's figuring out how to cooperate to get the job done. So let me try to explain that point of view as I see it. The new economics for a 21st century starts with the proposition that the challenges we face are unique. They're unique because the world we've created in a very short period of time, or that has been created by the generations, the few generations that preceded us, is unlike anything that human society has grappled with in scale. This is a graph, I don't know if people can see it, and I apologize for those in the back. This is a graph of the world's population. The main thing you need to see is that this flat line for 1900 years shown in the graph showed a tiny, tiny, tiny rate of increase of world population from one century to the next, imperceptible from one year to the next. And then starting around 1750, the curve started to turn up, and then, of course, it went wild in the last two centuries. So from the beginning of from AD 1, let me put it that way, from AD 1 to 1900, the world's population rose from about 500 million to about 750 million. That whole period maybe added 250 million to the population. By 1830, another 250 million were added to reach a billion population for the first time. One century later, so in 100 years, the second billion was added by 1930. By 1950, the third billion was added. By 1975, the fourth billion was added. Then the fifth, then the sixth by 2000. We're now at 6.7 billion people. So this was, for a long time, super exponential growth, meaning that the rate of growth was itself increasing decade to decade during the last two centuries. And before we knew it, we were 10 times more people than at the start of the Industrial Revolution. The water didn't change, the land area didn't change, the forests, well, they disappeared by and large. The number of mouths to feed did rise tenfold. The stressors on the physical environment rose much more than that, because at the same time, income per person, measuring the amount of resources that we're each using on average, though on average it's not fair for an American to speak that way because we use at least four or five times more resources than the average of the world, and typically 20 or maybe 50 times more than the per capita resources of a poor person in the world. But the average resources used per person in the world also multiplied extraordinarily because of human ingenuity, the capacity to mobilize energy and technology to do absolutely astounding and wonderful things. And so the world's output, which is shown by this curve, is even more steeply rising in the last two centuries. Rather than increasing tenfold, it has increased 100-fold. Because the per person output on average has gone up 10 times, and the number of people has gone up 10 times, and the product, which roughly measures what we are using in resources and to some extent what we're enjoying in return, at least in per capita sense, exploded in an unprecedented way. Just like the world population was fairly stable during 1900 or 1800 years of almost stable technology, it was the technological revolution that enabled this to happen. And of course, they're completely interlinked. It's been pointed out, and I think rightly, that the key technology, for example, that enables 6.7 billion people to live on the planet was the mobilization of energy for producing fertilizer, nitrogen-based fertilizer, a discovery that took place between 1908 and 1914 called the Haber-Bosch process. That changed the world as fundamentally as anything else because it enabled at least five of those 6.7 billion people to be fed at least adequately. The other billion and a half are still struggling for the most basic decency of diet. But that kind of interaction of the economy and technology and population changed the world. Now, finally, in terms of economy, for 150 years, development was dominated by the North Atlantic. It started there. You needed coal for the first 100 years to develop, because no one had figured out how to use oil until the internal combustion engine was discovered. It's kind of a nasty trick for the Middle East that by the time oil was discovered, the North Atlantic was so dominant that it conquered the Middle East before the oil could be put to use. And so the next 75 years was still under Western domination, in effect. And this whole fossil fuel era meant that for the first 150 years or so of the industrial age, the gap between the West and the rest widened. It widened pretty relentlessly. First, because the technological drivers were coming from the North Atlantic. Then those were translated into military power, and that was the further amplifier. It's interesting, by the way, in Egyptian history, at least as I understand it, that the Mamluk leader Muhammad Ali in the 1840s tried to industrialize through a pretty central, through a pretty sensible policy of adopting the new Western technologies. The real break here in the 1840s and the 1850s, though, was the lack of energy resources. Because the new factories, especially the textile mills that were imported for Egypt, had to be fed by coal also imported from the rest of the world, and you couldn't make that work. It wasn't so much governance as simple economic geography. But then, of course, the military domination of the West took hold. The colonial era, in my opinion, was no friend of development for the rest of the world. Some historians like Neil Ferguson, argue that colonial rule was a transmission belt of technology. I think that's mostly nonsense. I think colonial rule was a break against the development of the local talents and freedom of action to use technology effectively. I mention all of this because all of that changed, in my opinion, starting around 1950 in this country as well. And that's because World War II brought to an end the European imperial system. Sovereignty was reestablished. A lot of countries made a lot of mistakes in policy, but they gained sovereignty in real economic terms, and those who figured out how to use it effectively were suddenly in a new era where technology was available. The improvements of technology meant that it could diffuse more widely in the world. Countries could now chart their own economic futures. Literacy had spread to most of the world, and therefore the chance for economic catching up became the dominant pattern of global change. This is why, fundamentally, the leadership of the North Atlantic is coming to an end. Not because the North Atlantic is crumbling, although I wouldn't want to argue too strongly this year. It looks bad, but it's not really more than a business cycle. But rather because the rest of the world is catching up. And it was economic sovereignty, the spread of literacy, the spread of scientific capacity, and the convergence gradually on sensible economic development strategies that allowed this catching up to take place. And what that will mean is the transition to a more Asia-centered and certainly a more multipolar economic world, as well as a more multipolar geopolitical world. Now, economists, and in my own thinking, I put great stress on this catching up growth. There's an advantage in growth terms to, quote, relative backwardness, an idea that a teacher of mine, Alexander Gershenkron, wrote about a half a century ago. That if you're catching up and there's technology out there that can be adopted, you have a chance for very rapid growth, even leapfrogging growth. And that's certainly been the pattern that China, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and I think in recent years Egypt as well, have successfully adopted. A possibility of mobilization of technology for very rapid economic growth. And even through this business cycle, that will continue. The U.S. will have an absolute decline of output this year, maybe down 3%. could even be down more, but possibly a decline of 3%, a very sharp recession. China is likely to grow by 7 or 8% this year. That's just another year of rapid narrowing of the gap of incomes between the U.S. and China. India will still master probably 5 to 6% per year economic growth. That will continue to narrow the gap. That underlying trend, I think, is profound and essentially available for developing countries that get the rest of their societal framework suitable and sustainable. And I'll say more about that just now. What about environmental sustainability? This is actually the greatest single challenge that the world faces and that the individual developing countries, and I'll put Egypt in the list, of countries for whom environmental sustainability will come to dominate the societal concerns for long-term development. Because this is a ribbon of a country in the desert, extraordinarily fragile. Population in 1950, 20 million people. Population today, 80 plus million people. Population by 2050 could be 120, could be even 150 million people. But it won't be people well provisioned and well attended to if the numbers reach those levels, because the ecological stress is already profound. Well, you surely can't. If you can read that, you win for best eyesight in the world. This is a picture with a bunch of bars on it. Otherwise, it's a miserable thing to put in a PowerPoint projection. What it is from a famous paper by a wonderful ecologist named Peter Vitusik at Stanford University, measuring the extent to which human beings are now taking over fundamental ecological processes in the world to a dangerous extent. We don't want to take over the water cycle, to take over the carbon cycle, to take over the nitrogen cycle. But that's what we're doing as a species because of that hundredfold increase of human activity. And that is unprecedented in character and also beyond our real ability to understand the risks involved. We're learning along the way as disasters befall us. What Vitusik did in each of those bars is to look at one aspect of ecosystem performance. The first bar is land transformation, the second CO2, the third water, the fourth nitrogen, the fifth invasive species of plants, the sixth extinctions of birds, and the seventh depletion of marine fisheries. And what his team showed in a rigorous way is that humans are now the fundamental drivers of these processes to an absolutely harrowing extent. And based on this idea, the Nobel laureate Paul Crutzen, who is an atmospheric scientist among the three who discovered the ozone depletion effect, gave a new name to our era. The geologists call our era the Holocene, as the period since the end of the Ice Age. But Crutzen said, no, we're not in the Holocene, we're in the Anthropocene. We're in the human-made geologic era. What I found fascinating is that this past year, the American Geologic Society looked at this question not as a metaphor, as I would use it, as an advocate or a political scientist or an economist, but as a literal geologic question. Would a geologist looking at the geologic patterns deem, by traditional dating purposes, this to be a new era? And they reached the conclusion, yes. If you look at sedimentation rates, if you look at fundamental changes of Earth systems, looking back, if you were looking at the paleoclimate, you would say this is a new era. And so the American Geologic Society is taking what I thought was a wonderful metaphor to be a literal geologic observation as well. Now, the shocking thing about this very quickly, and I won't go through all of this because you know about the carbon concentration and the climate change and the sources of carbon dioxide emissions, is how pervasive these drivers are. I had an institute at Columbia University, the Earth Institute, as Lisa told you, involved in sustainability science. So we have ecologists, we have agronomists, we have hydrologists, we have climatologists. Wherever you look, the drivers on Earth systems are at unprecedented and multi-dimensional stresses. And to summarize it, I think, as if we're in an Agatha Christie murder mystery, what we're murdering is the Earth. And like in an Agatha Christie novel, there are 10 suspects every time you look. Why are the amphibians disappearing? Why are the corals disappearing? Why are the pollinators disappearing? And then the debate starts. It's climate change. It's acidification of the oceans. It's excessive fishing. It's destruction of the related biodiversity. It's hydrologic cycles. Wherever you look, we're putting so many multiple stresses on the ecosystems that we can't even allocate anymore the nature of the causal elements of the specific, sometimes abrupt, dramatic changes that are underway. Dying off of half the amphibious species in some parts of the world. Why? Nobody knows. Is it new pathogens that have infected them? Is it destruction of their habitat? Is it chemistry changes of nitrogen cycling or other cycling? Nobody knows. Why are the corals dying in all parts of the world? Last week, Science recorded very carefully the slowdown of growth along several points of the Great Barrier Reef. Is it ocean acidification? Is it ocean warming? Is it increased turbulence of the seas because of storm events? Is it the destruction of symbiotic species? Nobody knows. And so this is the point about such strong multiple stressors. And it's one of the reasons why people that say, what's another degree centigrade going to do to us, just don't get it. Because we're pushing against margins on so many dimensions that we're constantly finding ourselves at the edge of or right over the cliff in terms of species abundance, in terms of functioning of ecosystems, in terms of resilience, ability to bounce back from disasters, and the like. Now, all of this, because I'm going to become far too pessimistic in the remaining few minutes unless I quickly point out, all of these stressors are from identified and rectifiable human-induced systems. This is critical. There's nothing that we're doing, even though we can't allocate the causes, that can't be subject to correction. So many of the factors that are deranging our ecosystems, of course, relate fundamentally to fossil fuel use. That's what's changing the climate, temperature and water cycle. It's what's changing ocean chemistry with acidification. It's what's changing the estuaries around the world through eutrophication of the estuaries, through the runoff of nitrogen-based fertilizers and the like. We can identify the causes. And the beauty of being so productive that you can destroy the Earth is that at the same time you can be so productive that you can cleverly find alternative answers. We nearly destroyed a lot of our life and well-being through ozone depletion. But it turned out that the cost of moving away from ozone depletion wasn't to end the use of refrigerators and deodorants, which were the two main uses for the chlorofluorocarbons, but actually to slightly engineer different chemical compounds that didn't have the ozone depleting effect. The costs of ending the ozone depletion were tiny in the end. It was almost in that case, which is too good to be true, a little bit of technological tinkering to substitute Freon and CFC-based aerosol cans with other substances. But it's an example that just because we're busy doing unconscionably large damage and risk to the world doesn't mean that the economic costs of getting out of this have to be similarly so enormous. And maybe the right way to do this, this is a picture of Egypt's future. It's one of these solar fields, a solar concentrator field. Egypt will provide a lot of the world's electricity in the future. I know it, because the deserts are going to bloom with mirrors. It's just going to be a good way to provide the energy for the world. And the reason is shown in this nice map. All of the world's electricity generation, all of the world's, can be powered by a part of the desert given by this box. All of Europe's is that. And since this was done by a German team, all of Germany's needs and North Africa's needs are by that little dot. This is technology already at hand. It's the sun, concentrated in solar collectors, and then turned into either thermal energy through steam turbines and concentrated solar thermal, or concentrating the solar in new kinds of photovoltaics, both of which are already demonstrated technologies. They're a little bit more expensive than the fossil fuels, though their price is coming down and the fossil fuel prices will go up. But the beauty of it is that there's no unfathomable mystery to how one could get out of the Anthropocene's devastation through fossil fuel use. And anyone who says the party's over and I have a whole shelf of books describing the end of civilization because of peak oil doesn't quite get it. Certainly that's not right in an economic or a technological sense, because the alternatives are at hand. And an interesting thing, by the way, is that you might say, well, but you still need the oil, don't you, to drive the cars, for example. And I think within 10 years, the whole world is going to move to electric-powered vehicles as the primary propulsion source. This is going to happen in a few years in the United States. It's happening right now. It's the price, or not the price, it will be the way that GM makes peace with society to avoid bankruptcy and to move into leadership in the 21st century. They're going to move to plug-in hybrids with the rollout next year. Within 10 years, they'll have, in addition, all battery vehicles, and they will also have fuel cell-powered vehicles. Fuel cells powered by hydrogen that have to be made by what else? Solar power or some other technology to split water. But the point is, we have no shortage of energy in the world, and we have no shortage of technologies already existing to deliver that energy. But we do have to remake our technological systems. And a place like Egypt, when you look at the solar insulation maps, is thrillingly endowed with sunshine. And being thrillingly endowed with sunshine will make this one of the power generator sites of the world. That's the plan, and that's the plan of this particular project, which I admire, which is called DESERTEC, for a renewable energy technology network to link the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe in a high voltage, direct current grid, essentially carrying solar power from North Africa and the Middle East to, well, both for its own use and to Europe's use. This is another technology which I would discuss a lot in China and India, and will be relevant also for the Persian Gulf, and that's using fossil fuel but putting the carbon dioxide back underground, which in the oil regions is great because it's got a positive economic value for enhanced oil recovery, but may be worthwhile even when there isn't oil to enhance, but rather simply to keep it out of harm's way. And in India last week, we were discussing the initiation of such a demonstration project for capturing and storing carbon dioxide. Now, quickly, the water crisis, which is par for this region, is another driver of fundamental economic and geopolitical significance, in my opinion. And like the Agatha Christie novels, when you look at water stress, you got many potential culprits. Indeed, they're all working together. It's the population increase to begin with, it's groundwater depletion, it's the disappearance of glacier and snowmelt through global warming, it's the more rapid evapotranspiration that comes through higher ambient temperatures, and of course, it's fundamental changes of precipitation patterns taking place because of the overall climate change underway. Egypt doesn't have to worry too much. It's in a region which will get drier, if you can imagine. But it's not the precipitation that's the main driver, I suppose, although ecologists may correct me, that's the main driver here. Of course, it's the Nile that's the main driver of Egypt's water lifeline. But all of the places that are dry in the world right now, not all, but almost all, will tend to get drier. That band, like the Sahel, North Africa, the Mojave Desert in the United States, the American Southwest, is all on the descending arm of the Hadley cell circulation, of the rising warm, wet air at the equator, which drops the rain over the rainforest, then descends as dry descending air over the deserts here. And that convective circulation intensifies in a warmer world, which means you have even more drying over the drylands. We're experiencing in the American Southwest, which is going from semi-dry to arid. And we have prolonged droughts now, and we could enter a mega drought era in the American Southwest. That's great. That's the fastest population growth in our whole country. Of course, they're building pipelines to rivers that are going to run dry and all the rest in the wonderful style of thoughtful development. Now, the reason that I take a lot of special interest in this is that the drylands tend to be the world's poorest regions. They also tend to be the world's most stressed regions in social instability. If you have a river that for 5,000 years has been effectively used for irrigation, the circumstances are a little bit different. That poses its own profound challenges and civilizational patterns. But in places that are not irrigated in the drylands, you vary from impoverished subsistence farmers to still more dry, impoverished subsistence pastoralist communities. We're working in a lot of these in Africa. They are all prone to social explosion right now because these are hungry places and they're getting hungrier. It's like two blades of the scissors. One is the demography continues to soar because you go to almost any impoverished rural area in Africa, the Middle East, or Central Asia, and women are still having 6 or 7 children. And there's a descending blade, which is declining precipitation. And finally, those two blades cut. And that is my interpretation, for example, of the Darfur crisis. That is fundamentally a water crisis. People are hungry. Nomads from the north of Darfur moved south trying to find water. What they found was sedentary populations, and they've tried to ethnically cleanse them so that they could grab the water. That's a one sentence, perhaps a dramatically oversimplified description, but it's not wrong. It's just taking the most fundamental ecological lens of this. So what this map shows in the yellow areas are the drylands of the world, and the red cones are conflict zones. And you see, it's not a perfect fit. I'm not a geographical determinist or an ecological determinist, but it's no accident that this whole stretch across the Sahel, through Yemen, through the countries of the Middle East, and into the frontier provinces of Pakistan and Afghanistan, in my opinion, are in great stress, because pastoralism is the most stressed pattern of life on the planet. And because the ecology cannot sustain the traditional ways of life, and because sedentary populations trying to grow a single crop of millet or sorghum in this world are dying of hunger. And when things go from bad to worse, you end up with Somalia, you end up with Darfur, you end up with Yemen's potential phenomenal instability, you end up with Afghanistan in its fifth or sixth year now of mega drought. The problem in the world is we interpret all of this through ideological, cultural, or religious lines. That's our mistake. If we would just look and listen, we'd understand that these are hungry people. And you can send in all the armies in the world, but you're not going to get one more drop of water that way. And I can tell you a story. I know I'm way late, but it's important. I don't know if it's important. For me, it was important. I keep saying at the UN, we have to approach Darfur from a development point of view. But the diplomats and the military strategists and the political strategists want to approach it from a strategic point of view, from a peacekeeping point of view, from a geopolitical point of view, from a fundamentalism point of view, whatever it is, but not from a water and development point of view. So one day I got a call, Professor Sachs, please come urgently to a high-level meeting at the United Nations to talk about water in Darfur. I said, finally. Progress. I got there, it was a briefing of the DPKO, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, and they were asking for some advice. What was the problem? The problem was that they couldn't figure out how they would station 26,000 peacekeepers because there wasn't enough water for them. That was the purpose of the urgent meeting. I very unhelpfully said three times in the meeting, but that's 26,000, there's 7 million people in Darfur. That probably gives you an idea about the water problem. Couldn't be heard. The problem was a practical one. How are we going to station the peacekeepers? So this is what happens at the end of ecological catastrophe. You get ecological refugees that aren't called that. You get people desperately fleeing from home. You get people trying to cross borders, getting shot at other countries' borders. Nobody likes dispossessed people showing up on their shores, on their borders, in their farms. Nobody. And yet we're creating a world where this could happen by the millions or the tens of millions or the hundreds of millions. That's why the work of the Desert Research Center here is so extraordinarily important. Please don't view this only, although only is in quotation marks, as a project about an oasis and the curiosities of what can be done. Because this is a fundamental challenge about peace also, and about livelihoods and sustainability for hundreds of millions of people in the most risk-prone zone of the whole world. And I put that in as a plug because I want to work with you guys. we have work in several villages in dryland areas. I regard it as the hardest work being done, and we need to figure out the answers, and we need the science and know-how of the universities to help do that. Well, very quickly, and then I'll stop. That line, those lines, depending on how you label them, are either the share prices of Lehman Brothers, Bank of America, and Citibank, or the water lines in the groundwater aquifers, but these happen to be a species, an abundance, an index of species abundance for different ecosystems. So this is a graph made by the World Wildlife Foundation over a 30-year period in their index of species abundance, showing the continuing catastrophic declines in species abundance. I'm going to very quickly show Egypt's population. I passed the world population graphs, but Egypt exemplifies the case. And that is that all of this, if we just continue on a business-as-usual course, will lead us to really catastrophic ends. We will not be able to manage this. The current trajectory for Egypt's population growth is that the 20 million in 1950 will grow to something like 120 million by mid-century. A slightly less optimistic scenario in which the total fertility rate doesn't drop quite as much puts Egypt's population at 140 million by 2050. The good news is that with extension of family planning and simply reducing the fertility rates from their current gradual decline by one half child on average per woman, just a small change of fertility practice, the population stabilizes at a near 100 million people, a fivefold increase which then plateaus and could even begin to decline afterwards. This is the baseline of the challenge, because all of those 120 million people on the basic trajectory, by the way, which already assumes a gradual decline of total fertility, all of those people want their place, I should say their place in the sun. They're definitely going to have their place in the sun. But they also want their place at the table. They want their resources. They want their ability to lead an adequate life economically. And for the world as a whole, that would mean a population of 9.2 billion people by mid-century. We can't make it sustainably that way. And when you take into account that all of the increase that is now underway is in the poorer countries, and almost all of the increase is in the poorer parts of the very poor countries, precisely the places that are under the most ecological stress, the most economic marginalization, the most socio-political turmoil, we know we have a problem that we've not addressed. Oh, so much that I wanted to say, but very quickly I'm going to say one more thing and then come to a conclusion. I really am, Lisa. We need, as universities, to become deeply involved in the practical problem solving of our time. There can't be not only ivory towers, wonderful sandstone edifices, limestone. There cannot be pristine, wonderful structures as retreats from the world, if there ever were, because the knowledge and the cross-disciplinary knowledge needed for sustainable problem solving is only centered now, in academia. It's an odd claim. It's one I've given a lot of thought to. Of course, business has great technology. Government may have power, though they don't feel like it often. But to put together the networks of knowledge that in an unbiased, forward-looking, and long-term manner can address these challenges of sustainable development, in my view, is a unique task and a unique privilege of academia. We're not in the middle of the political thicket, and we can be respected on all sides for that very reason. We're not out to make an immediate buck. We're usually begging for them, not making them. I say we're decidedly nonprofit organizations. And that also gives a measure that what we're out to do is to figure out things, to try to solve problems. And our success is getting things right and accurate on behalf of the people who we're aiming to help and the problems that we're aiming to address. Columbia University, before my time at Columbia, did something absolutely wonderful, which was to create a unique interdisciplinary initiative called the Earth Institute, which brought together the earth scientists, such as climatologists and seismologists and oceanographers, together with the ecologists and conservation biologists, together with the environmental engineers and the industrial ecologists and the mechanical engineers and the civil engineers, together with the political scientists, the economists, the anthropologists, the legal specialists, increasingly, the business development specialists, together with the public health and medical specialties, to say, work on these problems because they're not coming packaged as individual disciplines. One of the results of that is interdisciplinary work in the field, like you're doing in Farafra and other of the oases areas, dryland areas, desert areas where the Desert Research Center is working. Because you have a team that knows a piece of the puzzle, but together can address more holistically the challenges. And what's, of course, the essential truth is that the people living in these stressed environments live full lives and aren't looking for the answer to water or to health or to education on their own. They're looking to viable communities which have solutions for each of these underlying fundamental features of a normal life. And so we have been working in a project which I hope we can find ways to partner in the future, because I think it is a kind of project, as I was hearing from the Egyptian government all through the day, in its own ways with its own unique features, is already being applied and thinking in this country, of course, with the characteristics needed here. We call it the Millennium Village Project. The idea is to address the sustainable development challenges of the world's poorest people, where they live on site, through interdisciplinary, science-based approaches that address needs in agriculture, in water, in health, in education, in infrastructure, and in business development. The things that any healthy community, whether it's at a village scale or at the global scale, need for sustainability. And quickly, and I won't go through it, I'll leave the slides, I left one dryland area in our project, which is a village in Kenya, just on the Somalia border. It's probably not so different from the place Farafra, because it's also a place defined by a bore well. Without the bore well, there'd be nobody surviving there. It's an almost desert region. There's grazing land, but fairly low productivity, 200 millimeter rainfall land. A semi-nomadic camel, sheep, and goat herder population living in subsistence. And we have the pleasure and honor to be working with them to see how to help achieve what I call 21st century pastoralist sustainability. And it's a thrill. And the reason it's a thrill is that the project itself is led by a PhD Kenyan of Somali ethnicity who grew up in a family of eight brothers and sisters in extreme poverty in a nomadic community and found his way to a PhD, and now is going back and applying his PhD in resource management and sustainable development in the most ingenious and brilliant ways, whether it's improving the livestock herds, veterinary care, marketing, integrating distance learning, integrating distance health, integrating new solutions for water management, because our technologies really are so powerful, so good, that these problems can be solved. And this goes through a number of the illustrations, and I know I've run out of time to talk about them except the will to find ways to cooperate. I must conclude, however, with I must conclude with two other points. The resources we need to solve these problems are perhaps 2 or 3% of our annual income worldwide on a sustainable basis for several decades to come. That's not a small amount of money, because if the world GNP is $60 trillion, which it is right now, 2 or 3% is between $1 and $2 trillion, basically, per year. So I'm not talking about spare change. But I am talking, again, I'll say it, 1 to 2% of our income. Now, we know where that can come from. I'll give you two candidates. One is, we just bail out some banks in the U.S. Those bankers pocketed $18 billion of bonuses last month. $18 billion. My neighbors in Manhattan. I like my neighbors, but I don't like that. So I'm recommending that they give that back. And $18 billion is actually 3 times more than the United States spends each year for all of African development. What just went like that into the pockets of some bankers? That's how weird the world is. The other way that it's weird is that we have spent more in Iraq than all the aid the world has ever given in history for Africa. I'll say that again. American expenditures in the war in Iraq are more than all the aid the whole world has ever spent total cumulatively for all the aid to Africa. Then, since I'm in the business of begging money for Africa, I'm told, sorry, you know, we've got a budget squeeze. We don't have a budget squeeze. We got a money squeeze. We're not thinking straight. This is a map of U.S. military spending. And this is what the rest of the world spends. This bar is a little out of date because it's 2 years old now. It should be pretty much equal to the total military spending of the rest of the world. Now, the U.S. is 5% of the world, and the rest of the world is 95% of the world's population. We don't have to spend the same amount as all the rest of the world combined. That's what I call a waste of money. Here's our foreign policy in the United States up until now. There are supposedly 4 pillars of our foreign policy: military, development, international security, and diplomacy. Try to build a house on those 4 pillars. The roof caves in. So I'll end with this gentleman who I think was an inspiration for us through his words that, for me, live on until we get it right. And one of the things he said, John Kennedy, in my favorite speech of any American president in modern history, is a speech that he gave in 1963, June 10, 1963, when he said we could make peace with the Soviet Union and stop wasting so much money on arms that we could direct towards peaceful purposes. And it was a remarkable speech, because it was just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it took unbelievable bravery
an unbelievable vision to say to the American people, you know, it's possible to make peace with the other side. Because it had seemed that we had just come to the brink of annihilation, and he knew it. And he gave a speech that said, our values are even more important in determining whether we have peace or not than the other side's. We are the masters of our fate. And if we look inward and choose right, we'll find partners in this. And sure enough, when Khrushchev heard this great speech, now known as his peace speech, he said, I want to make an agreement with this man. 5 weeks later came the partial nuclear test ban treaty signed in Moscow, a speech changing history. And one of the things he said I particularly like and believe in, though I urge you all on the internet to listen to the whole speech, the commencement address at American University on June 10, 1963. But one of the things that he said is, so let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all share the same small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all immortal. Thank you very much.
Professor Sachs took a little longer than he said he would, but that was a summary of his 13-week semester course, so you should feel privileged to have
gotten
it all. You've
been spared.
We have a little bit of time for questions, so I want to entertain a few questions, and I am going to privilege the people who were standing all the way through the talk. Sir. There's a mic coming. Do you have a...
Good evening. It's a question from Reuters News Agency.
Please.
Professor Sachs, if I understood you correctly, the crisis in Darfur will not end unless it's being addressed from a development angle. But you have many people, rebels, analysts, and others, say that we need first a conflict suspension before conflict resolution. The fighting needs to stop. So how do you reconcile both? I mean, when the development stops, starts and conflict ends and things like this. Second question is, do you mean that even though we're going through this global financial crisis, we still have enough resources to tackle poverty through cutting wasteful spending? Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Of course, if you think about the specific tactics of ending a conflict like Darfur, there will have to be peacekeepers as part of this, no doubt. There will have to be security arrangements. But what I find problematic about the way that this issue is addressed is that those issues are almost the only issues that are put forward without also putting alongside the full development challenge and addressing that coherently, directly, and I would say honestly in a way. Now, what I mean by that is that when the failed attempt so far failed to get a peace agreement between the government and the rebel groups was signed a couple of years ago, a large part of that negotiation, it was clear, was the concern of the rebellious groups over the economic desperation and marginalization of the region. In fact, there's a clause in the Darfur peace agreement about achieving the Millennium Development Goals in Darfur, which is where I come into this as special advisor on the Millennium Development Goals for the UN Secretary General. Now, I know something about achieving the Millennium Development Goals in a peaceful circumstance in a place like Darfur. It's very hard. It requires integrated village-based investments in water and in agriculture and livestock and transport and communications and so on. It should be done. It's vitally important. There's been no serious international discussion of that. Sometimes when I raise this with diplomats from the rich countries, they say, no, we don't want to encourage that right now because we think Khartoum is in bad behavior and they have to do this and they have to do that and they have to do that for us to finalize something, or we'll just get into a bidding game and so on. I think this is wrong. This is not the right approach. The right approach is to start from the position that Darfur is one of the most impoverished places on the whole planet. It's one of the most ecologically and economically stressed parts of the whole planet. When the British were in control of Sudan, it was also one of the most desperately impoverished places that the British invested nothing in. Nothing. In fact, they took almost pride in the mid-1930s in saying, only the chief's son is getting educated here. You know, lest there be unrest. So we've not faced, honestly, a crisis like this, which starts with poverty, and which can bring lots of people together under a common challenge of fighting poverty, not under the divisions. And so it's tactics. It's not to say you wouldn't need, in the end, separating forces, you wouldn't need decommissioning soldiers, you wouldn't need security guarantees on various sides. But it shouldn't be viewed purely as who's wrong and who's right, but who's poor and how can that be addressed. And I think that would be a major practical advance. Now, in terms of fighting poverty, my studies have shown, and shown to my satisfaction, I have to say, that the international target of allocating 0.7% of rich world income would be create a sufficient fund of money, in this case 0.7% of $35 trillion of rich world income, those are the donors. That would be about $245 billion a year for aid. It would be an extra $140 billion more than is currently delivered. Boy, I know what you could do with $140 billion. Because for about $40 billion, you could comprehensively ensure access to primary health care. For another $20 billion, you could comprehensively ensure at least minimally safe drinking water. For another $20 billion a year, you could address the needs of impoverished smallholder farmers, and so forth. So, yes, for 0.7% of 1%, you could address the poorest people, the billion or so living in extreme hunger, poverty, and without access to basic primary health in a comprehensive manner. Why don't we do it? Well, there's not a deep reason, because Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, Luxembourg are five countries that do that amount. And a number of other countries, Ireland, Spain, and some others, are raising their aid levels right now. The problem is the big countries, the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, Italy, France, are not doing it. So I don't think it's just a general point that we don't care, won't do it, Democratic politicians look only to their local constituencies, won't do it. Because I know lots of politicians. I had dinner with the Prime Minister of Norway last week. They give, and he champions, 1% of their national income in development aid every year. If the United States did that compared to what it does right now, we would be giving another $100 billion a year of aid. $100 billion. Could we afford it? For sure. We spend $200 billion directly on these useless wars. Directly. And we're going to spend trillions on the bank bailouts. And the investment bankers were taking $30 billion of bonuses, which have only come down to $18.4 billion in the worst crash in modern history, funded by the U.S. government, thank you. So of course we could afford this. We've just not chosen to afford it. American people do not see development as a way out of their security. They see the military as a way out, although they're learning to the contrary. The generals are often, many of the generals are far ahead of this. They know you put the troops there, it's useless. But the American public believe that these are military approaches. I think they're getting more clever on that. We have a very smart president. I hope that he has the wherewithal to get us out of that waste, but more than that, not just to save the money, quote, for Americans, but really help make us secure by investing in solutions for the world, because that's the security that we all need.
I'm just going to take one more.
Go ahead.
Wait. All these I have two questions.
Since the papers say today would be Darwin's 200th birthday, I'm wondering if you have...
I'm sorry, say it again?
It's Darwin's 200th birthday, 9th of February. People haven't really cooperated historically. They've competed to adapt. So why would we cooperate now? And when people have cooperated through human civilization, they have done so on the basis of inequity, by espousing systems of tragic inequity like gender, like race, like caste. So do you have any thoughts on how we can change this fundamental human trait of not cooperating around equity? And a small question, if you have any comments on this book that came out by Dee Moyo called Dead Aid, which is a critique of your work, saying that Africa doesn't really need aid. It needs bond issues and free market forces and so on.
Sure. On the first, in that same speech, John Kennedy said, I'm not calling for a revolution in human nature, but an evolution in human institutions. A step-by-step series of practical agreements that are in the interests of all concerned. And that's the basic point. We're not going to remake human nature, but we can redesign human institutions to solve some problems in the mutual benefit. And there are very practical things that can be done in ways of funding and so forth. I've worked on helping to establish a global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria a few years ago, for example. And it is saving lots of lives because it's a very practical, straightforward step. And I think that public awareness and education of what can be done is extremely important. In the end of the day, the politicians really do follow the voters. They could once in a while lead. That would make this a quicker process. But if we're not going to do it that way, we're going to educate people into what we need to do and how we need to do it, and that puts the onus back on us as educators as well. I've not read this book, Debt Aid, but I find the proposition that Africa doesn't need aid absolutely pernicious and from my experience, deadly. Now, I worked on raising about $8 billion a year for people that were otherwise dying of AIDS, TB, and malaria. Is this author saying that was a bad idea? Is she saying that they would have stayed alive without access to the antiretrovirals? Well, no. At the time, she was studying at Harvard, and then at Oxford, and then at Goldman Sachs Global Institute. So I suggest she go and prove her theories in the villages and do it without any help, just using the local resources. And I'll do it with aid, and then we'll compare notes. So I think she's got it wrong, though with apologies because I haven't read the book, but I did read some interviews. And this is a matter of life and death for desperate people. It's not a matter of pride. It's not a matter of indignation. She doesn't like me as a white person arguing for, or that's how it was portrayed, arguing for someone with dark skin. I regard that as absurd. Absolutely absurd. This isn't a matter about indignation or not. Hungry people can't have the human dignity. Now, I know, because I'm dealing with scientists, that they can't grow a proper crop because their soils are nitrogen depleted. I also happen to know right now that the cost of properly farming a hectare of land is $250 a hectare. Now, I also happen to know that throughout Africa, poor people cannot afford $250 a hectare. So what happens? They die. Now, if they get aid, they can do what Malawi has done, which is given a voucher to each household so that they can get a tin of seed and two bags of fertilizer, 250 kg bags, one of basil, one of top dressing. What happened when Malawi did that, and I worked with the president for that? They doubled their food production. 3 years in a row now. Did that take away their human dignity? No, it did not. Did it make the children's brain cells develop properly? Yes, it did. Did it enable the children to go to school? Yes, it did. So I regard all of this as being attacked, speaking on behalf of Africans, taking away our dignity, we don't need your help, and so forth. I understand the sense of indignation because the rich world behaves atrociously, but I don't understand the lack of analysis. And the analysis is that desperately poor people need help. They've always needed help. I'll tell you something in this world. Everybody needs help. Nobody does anything on their own in this world. Not you, not me, not these rich bankers being bailed out, and not the poorest people in the world. And so I want her to go to the villages, not stand up and say about how this is taking away their dignity. Thanks.
End of our time, and I am going to, as is appropriate, give the last word to the president.
When we begin to think about and plan for this inaugural week, we talked about who on earth we wanted to have as the major speaker. And there was only one name that came up, and that name was Jeff Sachs. We're so thrilled and delighted and honored that he accepted Lisa's spontaneous invitation in such a spontaneous way. On behalf of all of us, I want to thank you for your call to action, your wake-up call, for helping us think about what we stand for and what we believe in as an institution, and what role we can and must play in helping to do our part to address the major challenges that you've put before us. And as an incentive to maintain your 30-year record and continue it into the future, we want you to come back to Cairo, and we're going to supply you with a small reading supply from the AUC Press to accompany you on your future airplane trips.
Thank you so much.